Book of Mormon Witnesses, Questions and Concerns. When we were first told to publish our statement, we felt sure the people would not believe it, for the book told of a people who were refined and dwelt in large cities. But the Lord told us that He would make it known to the people, and people should discover the ruins of lost cities and abundant evidence of the truth of what is written in the book. David Whitmer, 1883. There are 11 formal witnesses of the Book of Mormon plates beside Joseph Smith. 8 of these witnesses had a physical experience with the plates. They handled the plates, hefted them, thumbed through their leaves, and saw the engravings of the plates. The 3 witnesses, Martin Harris, David Whitmer, and Oliver Cowdery, had a very different experience. They had a supernatural visitation of an angel. The angel first appeared to David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery, and then later to Martin Harris. How do the critics explain away the testimony of the 11 witnesses? How do they explain the non-supernatural physical experience of the 8 witnesses? Then, how do they explain the supernatural experience of the 3 witnesses? If they can theorize one type away, aren't they still stuck with the other type? For example, some critics argue, without evidence, that Joseph Smith fabricated metal plates with convincing ancient-looking engravings to trick the 8 witnesses. If that is true, then how do they explain the 3 witnesses' angelic visitation? Other critics say, without evidence, that Joseph Smith was a master hypnotist. That's how he got David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery to see an angel and Martin Harris later on to see the same angel. This theory would make Joseph among the greatest, if not the greatest, hypnotist the world has ever known, long before the practice was in use. If I accept the hypnotist theory, aren't I still stuck with the physical, non-supernatural experience of the 8 witnesses? How realistic is it that Joseph Smith had such powerful hypnotic persuasion that he could make people see, hear, and feel visions even without him present? Have the world's greatest hypnotist ever achieved a feat remotely close to that? How could he produce the same angelic visitation in 2 instances for the 3 witnesses? If Joseph is such a potent hypnotist, why does he use that power to create Book of Mormon witnesses? If Joseph is a fraud and a liar, why not use those nearly mystical powers to enrich himself? He could have done almost anything with unnatural powers like that. Some critics tried to brush aside the witnesses because they were friends and associates of Joseph Smith. Critics do so to explain why the witnesses went along with the scheme initially. Well, which theory is it? Did he hypnotize them, or were they lying? Were they co-conspirators, or were they duped? It can't be both theories. How do critics explain the co-conspirators theory when many witnesses later became disillusioned with Joseph Smith and left the church? Why would the witnesses continue to lie when they were no longer a part of the church? Keep lying when, in some instances, they have every incentive to expose Joseph. The Book of Mormon witnesses were well regarded in the communities they lived in. How likely are 100% of the witnesses to lie for Joseph Smith? Some witnesses, like David Whitmer, left the church and never returned. Why did David Whitmer maintain his testimony of the Book of Mormon for the rest of his life? Didn't he have his testimony etched on his gravestone? Several of the Book of Mormon witnesses left the church but never denied their testimony. Doesn't that only strengthen the case for the truth of their testimonies regarding the authenticity of the Book of Mormon? I was inspired when I learned how much the witnesses sacrificed to maintain their testimony of the Book of Mormon. William McClellan relayed an experience in 1833 when one of the 8 witnesses, Hiram Page, was tracked down by the Jackson County mob. Under threat of death, Hiram maintained his testimony. Says William McClellan, quote, "The mob commenced beating and pounding him with whips and clubs. He begged, but there was no mercy. They said he was a damned Mormon, and they meant to beat him to death. But finally, one of them said to him, 'If you will deny that damned book, we will let you go.' Said he, 'How can I deny what I know to be true?' Then they pounded him again. When they thought he was about to breathe his last, he said to him, 'Now, what do you think of your God when he don't save you?' 'Well,' said he, 'I believe in God.' 'Well,' said one of the most intelligent among them, 'I believe that damn fool will stick to it though we kill him. Let us let him go.' But his life was nearly run out. He was confined to his bed for a length of time, so much for a man who knows for himself. Knowledge is beyond faith or doubt. It is positive certainty. Close quote. The witnesses conducted formal interviews for the rest of their lives. Critics looked for any sign of falsehood in their story of the Book of Mormon. This is the reason why doubters requested repeated interviews. If any witness had admitted that his testimony was a lie, any anti-Mormon-friendly media would have celebrated him. It may have even become front-page news around the country. Likely, he could have made some money from denying his testimony. Yet, in dozens of formal interviews and hundreds of informal secondary interactions, none of the witnesses ever denied their witness and testimony of the Book of Mormon. None. Not one time. The 11 formal Book of Mormon witnesses provided over 200 accounts affirming their testimony. At best, there are 8 to 10 second-hand and third-hand accounts that attempt to reframe their testimonies as non-literal events of a spiritual nature. Critics try to use the small handful of dubious accounts to discount the other 200. One such account is from a former pastor, John A. Clark, who considered Joseph Smith a fraud. He said, big air quotes, a gentleman in Palmyra told him that Martin Harris saw the plates with, big air quotes, an eye of faith. John Clark did not interview Martin Harris himself. He quoted someone he knew, unnamed. Critics jump on this instance of hearsay to say that the angelic experience did not happen. If I were to believe John Clark's account, how would I explain these statements from Martin Harris, some in direct response to John Clark's claims? Quote, gentlemen, do you see that hand? Are you sure you see it? Are your eyes playing a trick or something? No? Well, as sure as you see my hand, so sure did I see the angel and the plates. Close quote. Martin Harris. Quote, it is not a mere belief, but it is a matter of knowledge. I saw the plates and the inscription thereon. I saw the angel, and he showed them to me. Close quote. Martin Harris. Quote, well, just as plain as you see that chopping block, I saw the plates, and sooner than I would deny it, I would lay my head upon that chopping block and let you chop it off. Close quote. Martin Harris. Quote, no man ever heard me in any way deny the truth of the Book of Mormon and the administration of the angel that showed me the plates. Close quote. Martin Harris. In an interview with Anthony Metcalf, David Whitmer left no doubt about whether he saw with his spiritual or natural eyes. Quote, I was not under any hallucination. I saw with these eyes. David Whitmer. In an 1849 interview with Jacob Gates, Mr. Gates asked Oliver Cowdery, I want you to tell me the whole truth about your testimony concerning the Book of Mormon, the testimony sent forth to the world over your signature and found on the front of that book. Was your testimony based on a dream? Was it the imagination of your mind? Was it an illusion, a myth? Tell me truthfully. Here was Oliver's response. Quote, the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God. My eyes saw, my ears heard, my understanding was touched, and I know that whereof I testified is true. It was no dream, no vain imagination of the mind. It was real. Close quote. Didn't all three formal witnesses and many of the eight bear testimony of the Book of Mormon on their deathbeds? Imagine how frustrating it was to be a witness of the Book of Mormon. Let's say I had a sacred experience. I bear testimony to it. I include my name in the printing of the Book of Mormon. Then detractors scrutinize my account for the rest of my life and interview me dozens of times. A couple of secondhand hearsay accounts claim that some unidentified person told them something different than what I actually said. So now I have to do more interviews. Then, 180 years later, critics only refer to a couple of inaccurate accounts, despite my every effort to bear a faithful testimony. Critics, I'm genuinely curious. How many interviews would have been enough? Are hundreds of interviews sufficient? Is the testimony of the witnesses on their deathbeds and gravestones enough? What more could the witnesses have done to bear record of their testimony? Is there anything that the witnesses could have said that would have convinced the skeptics that they saw an angel and handled the plates? Would anything satisfy the critics? Why do these critics use a small handful of problematic second and third-hand accounts at the expense of the hundreds of primary accounts and the overall narrative? Is that what light and truth seekers do? In the end, if the Book of Mormon is a fraud, then one of two things has to be true. One, the 11 witnesses lied for Joseph Smith, or two, Joseph Smith swindled the witnesses very convincingly. Why did the 11 formal witnesses never deny their experience with the plates and the angel if it was a fraud? Why did they reaffirm their testimonies over and over? Why did they continue to lie for Joseph even when some were estranged from the church? If Joseph had swindled the witnesses, how did he fabricate convincing enough plates? How did he get David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery to see an angel? Then how did he get Martin Harris to see the same angel later that day? The CES letter attempts to discredit the witnesses. Jeremy insinuates that the Book of Mormon witnesses are a bunch of slack-jawed idiots, a band of superstitious buffoons incapable of knowing the difference between handling the plates and imagining handling the plates, backwater country yokels who were unaware of whether they saw an angel or not. Weren't Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris well-regarded in their social circles? Wasn't David Whitmer a city councilman and a mayor for a time in Richmond, Missouri? Wasn't Martin Harris a successful, industrious farmer? Wasn't Oliver Cowdery a clerk, teacher, lawyer, and newspaper editor? Beyond hundreds of individual affirmations, didn't all 11 witnesses reaffirm their testimony as a group on two other occasions? Some witnesses left the church during the Kirtland era and began criticizing Joseph Smith. Critics often reference this quote from Joseph to discredit the witnesses, quote, "Such characters as McClellan, John Whitmer, David Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, and Martin Harris are too mean to mention, and we would like to have forgotten them," close quote. Two important points here. First, calling these men mean is a rather mild rebuke. Second, by making this rebuke, Joseph shows absolutely no fear of his witnesses revealing his scheme or recanting their testimony. How can he be so confident? If they are in on the fraud, doesn't he have every reason to keep them in the fold and speak kindly of them? Instead of impeaching the witnesses, as critics suggest, this quote from Joseph does the exact opposite. "After learning more about these men, I am moved by their sacrifice to build up the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the early days. Likewise, I am inspired by the witnesses who left the church yet never faltered in their testimony despite every incentive to do so." Informal witnesses. Beyond the 11 formal witnesses, there are several unofficial witnesses to the Book of Mormon. A summary of some of them is listed below for Mormoner.org. Emma Smith. "The plates often lay on the table without any attempt at concealment, wrapped in a small linen cloth, which I had given them to fold them in. Once I felt of the plates, and they thus lay on the table, tracing their outline and shape. They seemed to be pliable like thick paper and would rustle with a metallic sound when the edges were moved by the thumb, as one does sometimes thumb the edges of a book." Lucy Mack Smith. "I asked her, Emma Smith, if she saw the plates. She said no, it was not for her to see them, but she hefted them and handled them." Lucy Harris. "Martin's wife had hefted the plates and felt them under a cover." William Smith. "In the winter of 1829 and 30, the Book of Mormon, which is the translation of the part of the plates obtained, was published. He then showed the plates to my father and my brothers, Hiram and Samuel, who were witnesses to the truth of the book which was translated from them. I was permitted to lift them as they laid on a pillowcase, but not to see them, as it was contrary to the commands that they had received. They weighed about 60 pounds, according to the best of my judgment." Catherine Smith Salisbury. "When Joseph was bringing the plates home from their hiding place to work on the translation, he was followed by his father's very door at one time by some men who were determined to get Joe Smith's gold plates, as they were called. Ever watchful for her brother's safety and hearing an unusual commotion outside, Catherine flew to the door and threw it open just as Joseph came running up, panting for breath. He thrust a bundle into her arms and in a gasping voice whispered hoarsely, 'Take these quickly and hide them.' Then he disappeared into the darkness. Closing the door, Catherine ran hurriedly to the bedroom where she and Sophronia slept. Sophronia threw back the bedding, and Catherine put the bundle on the bed, quickly replacing the bedding. Both of them lay down on the bed and pretended to sleep. The mob, failing to find Joseph outside, returned to the house to search, but they did not disturb the girls since they appeared to be sleeping. Catherine Smith Salisbury then told me that while dusting up the room where the prophet had his study, she saw a package on the table containing the gold plates, on which was engraved the story of the Book of Mormon. She said she hefted those plates and found them very heavy like gold and rippled her fingers up the edge of the plates and felt that they were separate metal plates and heard the tinkle of the sound that they made. Josiah Stoll. Witnesses saw a corner of it. It resembled a stone of a greenish cast, should judge it to have been about 1 foot square and 6 inches thick. He would not let it be seen by anyone. The Lord had commanded him not. It was unknown to Smith that witnesses saw a corner of the Bible, so called by Smith. Told the witnesses the leaves were of gold. There were written characters on the leaves. Alva Beeman. Joseph then took them, the plates, out and hid them under the old cooper's shop by taking up a board and digging in the ground and burying them. When they were taken from there, they were put in an old Ontario glass box. Old Mr. Beeman, Alva Moses Beeman, sawed off the ends, making the box the right length to put them in, and when they went in, he said he heard them jink, but he was not permitted to see them. He told me so. Harrison Burgess. The next day, while laboring in the field, something seemed to whisper to me, "Do you know the Book of Mormon is true?" My mind became perplexed and darkened, and I was so tormented in spirit that I left my work and retired into the woods. The misery and distress that I there experienced cannot be described. The tempter all the while seemed to say, "Do you know the Book of Mormon is true?" I remained in this situation about 2 hours. Finally, I resolved to know, by exercising faith similar to that which the brother Jared possessed, whether I'd proclaimed the truth or not, and commenced praying to God of heaven for a testimony of these things. Suddenly, a glorious personage clothed in white stood before me and exhibited to my view the plates from which the Book of Mormon was taken. Mary Musselman Whitmer. John C. Whitmer, a grandson of Mary Musselman Whitmer, testified in the following language. "I've heard my grandmother say on several occasions that she was shown the plates of the Book of Mormon by a holy angel, whom she always called Brother Nephi." She undoubtedly refers to Moroni, the angel who had given the plates in charge. "One evening, when, after having done her usual day's work in the house, she went to the barn to milk cows, she met a stranger carrying something on his back that looked like a knapsack. At first, she was a little afraid of him, but when he spoke to her in a kind, friendly tone and began to explain to her the nature of the work which was going on in her house, she was filled with inexpressible joy and satisfaction. He then untied his knapsack and showed her a bundle of plates, which in size and appearance corresponded with the description subsequently given by the witnesses to the Book of Mormon. This strange person turned the leaves of the book of the plates over, leaf after leaf, and also showed her the engravings upon them, after which he told her to be patient and faithful in bearing her burden a little longer, promising that if she would do so, she would be blessed and her reward would be sure if she proved faithful to the end. The personage then suddenly vanished with the plates. Where he went, she could not tell." Mary Whitmer's account is fascinating. Several secondhand witnesses describe an experience Mary relayed to them. With a house full of people busy translating the Book of Mormon, she was left to pick up the extra work of cooking, cleaning, and laundry on her own. With the extra house guests, it was especially burdensome. Amidst her frustration, she received a visitation from a stranger who showed her the plates. After showing her the plates, the stranger vanished. The experience helped her endure a little longer. How did Joseph Smith get Mary Whitmer to have an angelic visitation without his intervention or knowledge?